So for our in-person audience, just please state your name before asking your question. And for our online audience, you can ask a question by typing it into the Q&A box, or you can also use the microphone on your computer by selecting the raised hand feature from the menu above, and we will grant you microphone rights in the order the questions come in. Is there anything else, Emily? No, I think that covers it all. And if anyone on the line wants to ask a question, just please make sure you speak directly into your computer's microphone. So could we go back to the two questions you two had posted and just as prompts? But of course, any questions are welcome. And we do have one here from the chat that I'll just read to get us started. So this is from Allison Augustin. Hello, would love more detail on what is considered a confounding factor. We know that isolating the impact of the AmeriCorps member when in a complex environment such as a school can be challenging. So any thoughts on confounding?
Yeah, great question. So an example of confounding factors would be where it's you're unable to disentangle what the intervention might be doing versus just the context in which it might be implemented and could otherwise explain outcomes. So I think one example to help illustrate this is if you were trying to assess an education program where the teachers were putting a new curriculum in the classroom, but your treatment condition, it was just novice teachers, and then in the control condition, it was more experienced teachers. Because of those differences in who was implementing intervention being one group, but then the control group would have been qualitatively different from the other, you don't know if any differences you would see is because of the intervention or just because of the differences in the teaching experiences that these two groups have. So that would be an example of a confound where you can't really attribute any then outcome differences to the intervention versus those other factors that were inherent in the study design.
Thanks.
Clint Brass from the Congressional Research Service. So I don't have any special expertise in grants, but I understand that many of them are structured to last 3 years or 5 years. And one question that comes up occasionally is that when a grantee takes up an intervention, it takes a while for the intervention to mature, raising the question, do we have a valid construct here of what the intervention is as practiced as they you know, use an impact evaluation to look at it, but also use CQI and probably a variety of evaluation and research methods to kind of think about their process. So can you talk a little bit about just maturity of the intervention and kind of the glide path that occurs?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your question really touches on a lot of different things. One that comes to mind is the timing of the impact evaluation itself, knowing that some interventions might need a longer runway to really say, this is, we're finally here with the model we're trying to implement. And if you do that, the impact evaluation too soon, then you're going to prematurely get impact that you would otherwise have gotten had you waited. But I think, touching on what Nan spoke about too, is, it also speaks to the need for those sorts of implementation supports in terms of the intervention specification and readiness so that, because knowing that you may need a longer runway to get that model and put it into practice, that's why you need the CQI processes. That's why you need an implementation monitoring team to identify that those sort of issues are occurring and how do you address them over time. Because without that sort of implementation supports, you might think I am doing the model as it was intended, but you may not actually know that because you don't have the supports in place. You don't have the data systems to have that feedback loop. So it sort of speaks to the need of knowing that in advance, those are sort of challenges you might experience. So to be ready to scale, you want to do as much as you can to have those in place before you embark on that journey.
Can I ask a quick follow-up? So how does technical assistance play into that? Because in medicine, you have doctors kind of gliding on the same path with you as a patient, doing, in effect, interrupted time series. How does this feel? How is this working? And so kind of like for CNCS or other helpers there potentially.
I just wanted to say that I think that what you say is quite valid. It's something that CNCS would be grappling with. Right now, we're trying to sort of get more feel for how these interventions are being scaled up and how mentees are approaching them, because there's going to be some changes that does happen as you try to replicate and expand, and sort of getting a good grasp of sort of where that those iterations have veered off from what was supposed to be, to the extent that they're not changed, you know, are they really being implemented with fidelity? All of those sort of aspects come into play. I think what we're trying to do now at this stage is gain enough experience and, you know, tap what's happening on the ground, so we have a better position to do the support that you were talking about. So I think we're still a bit away from that, but we know that a lot of organizations and programs have started on this journey, so they have some experience that we want to tap into, and then all of those things come into play.
This is Lisbeth Little. I'm with the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of Policy and Strategy, Research and Evaluation Division. My question is more in terms of that frame, specifically the framework for scaling, right? Because the first thing that comes to my mind, you know, with experience of, you know, community work, and that is it's that of adaptation or modification of evidence-based mm-hmm. program, right? And scaling right now to me sounds more like size, this number of participants, mm-hmm. this number. But usually, and you actually addressed it also, the scaling is not so simple as just numbers, because oftentimes, you know, it's different kinds of individuals, youth, I mean, the range of modifications can be so wide, really. So I don't know if it's scaling anymore, or maybe other things, you know, maybe what I'm trying to get at, why is it scaling as important as probably other factors that may have to do with different kinds of modifications? Is scaling in terms of size, you know, the most important factor when you modify or try to implement an evidence-based program? Or is it other aspects? Like, even with the framework that you mentioned, you know, I am thinking, okay, staff. Staff can be numbers, 3 staff, 5 staff, but staff can also mean, you know, the experience, the kind of background that the staff has, and that. And then if you talk about grantees, I mean, usually they implement something based on their own experience or what it must be, but there are no really details on evidence-based programs necessarily about you need 3 staff per or the ratio, you know, per 5 participants, and they need to be experiencing this. So how do you, the myriad of factors is so much that I'm thinking about what framework are we really talking about, or how the framework, you know, meets those kind of complexity.
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. It's not, the framework's simple. Real world is not simple, and you touched on a lot of the complexity in your question. I think the point, well, one of the points is that you really have to be mindful of what you're doing. You know, you really need an intervention that you know what it's supposed to look like. You know where you're starting from. It's well-defined. The population is well-defined. You know, yes, you can adapt it. Yes, you know, most developers of interventions allow for some adaptation, you know, of it. That's without a doubt, you know. But you have to be mindful where it is. And then when you're going out from that, you have to really, again, be mindful. Is there evidence? What have you got? What evidence do you have to suggest that you're going to be successful on this new type of population? What evidence is out there? And yes, it's not going to be evidence that's exactly on your intervention, but maybe it's a reading literacy program that similar programs have been effective on this new population, or similar programs have been effective, you know, in this new area. you just have to be mindful and think through how it's going to be adapted and what evidence is out there and what evidence is out there that, that there are going to be challenges and can you overcome them. It's not as simple as the diagrams, absolutely not. But you know, yeah, purposeful and mindful come, are words that come to my mind.
There's a question down here too as well.
So. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to take a few from the chat. So Aaron Cruz says, she wants to know if CNCS is moving into evidence-based research, will all programmatic grants as a senior core AmeriCorps be required to move into higher evidence-based tiers? And if so, our federal indirect rate will be considered research, and will it be at a higher level, leaving less funds for operating a program? How will that work? Will we be able to apply for additional funding to cover that cost? Finally, moving programs into research means that grant will be needed to be submitted to the IRB, which can take 2 months. Will there be enough time for that? So just questions around how this is funded. And
so I would say I'm not a program person. This is Mary Hyde. I wouldn't venture to speak to programmatic policy issues, but I would say that I would hope that some of this information would be used to inform the ways in which we structure our grants, the ways in which we guide the investments, and certainly the AmeriCorps State National Grants have 3 years to conduct an evaluation. So certainly building in time for the IRB is something that could be accommodated by that time frame. But from an agency perspective, I think that is the space where we start to speak more intentionally with the programmatic side of the house and say, okay, what are the implications of this for how we fund and how dollars are allocated?
Thank you. So we're going between the live audience and the chat. So now the live audience.
Hi, this is Lori Frank, Health and Aging Policy Fellow. And I'm interested in the relationship between interventional readiness and organizational readiness and your plans for refining your framework. So I was very interested to see that some of your next steps are to look at facilitators and challenges mm-hmm. to scaling, which is terrific. But wanted to assess your level of optimism that you'll find generalizable principles, you know, how much is idiosyncratic to given conditions and how much really can be generalized, and then what your plans are for feeding that back into your framework.
Great question. And, you know, since we haven't started yet, I can have all the optimism in the world. And I do, actually. The framework wasn't developed in isolation. It's grounded, very, very heavily grounded, actually, in implementation science. And so it comes from a strong literature base. That said, you know, like I said in my discussion points, we're going to face challenges, and we will have to face, you know, feed those challenges back to the framework, absolutely. So I don't know, at this point, you know, we're not heading to the field until the fall. I think we've got good instruments in heading into the field that will capture, that have been designed based on the framework, as well as the nuances of, you know, the organizations and interventions selected. So I think we'll get the information that will allow us to go back and reconcile everything. I don't know, personally, I hope there's not a lot of reconciliation, but I can say that because it's only June. Check back next year this time. I may have a completely different answer.
We'll do a follow-up in a year.
Yeah.
So why don't you go ahead, and then I'll take a few from the chat.
Okay, great. Hi, I'm Pompa DeBroy. I'm from the Office of Evaluation Sciences at GSA. Thank you very much for your presentations. My question is, what we do is we evaluate different program changes. And my question is, when to continue building evidence versus when to suggest implementing or replicating or scaling? So are there criteria you would use around determining recommendations for those different different types of scaling.
So, just to clarify, in terms of continuing to fund or taking what's to scale, can you clarify that?
Well, continuing to study something. So, in different contexts, like how do you decide when it's appropriate to replicate something in a different context with different populations versus it's appropriate to go ahead and implement it or decide whether you want to replicate the study or scale?
Gotcha. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, did you want to go?
No, go ahead.
I would say, you know, if you're from a starting point, what you're doing doesn't have evidence of effectiveness, then you shouldn't be trying to scale until you have that underlying success, because, you know, you're trying to do what, either adapt to a new population or, you know, replicate, expand. You don't want to do that if what you're initially doing is not working. So I think from there, it's, you would want to then go back to your logic model or revisit, you know, what is it that you're doing and kind of do some adaptations at that sense to really go back to the lab and see if I give more dosage, if I add these components or less of that. So I think, as Nan was saying, a lot of our model is based on implementation science. It might just be revisiting some of these same exact parameters where maybe I need to adjust my core elements, or I have to think about who the staff was, how many of the staff, am I doing the right implementation support? So I think you can think about, if you're not having that underlying evidence to begin with, to, you know, kind of revisit, well, what is my model, and try to then keep working to develop more evidence. But, you know, we would say you wouldn't want to try to bring it on the road until you know that what you're doing in your local context or what you're trying to do first has that underlying evidence.
And I would say assume that there is underlying evidence for something, but there might be less evidence for a specific population or a specific context. At what point would you feel comfortable or have defined criteria around when would make sense to continue studying something versus?
Can I say something?
Yes,
absolutely. This is Lilizania. I just wanted to say that we see the evidence building piece as an ongoing process. I don't really see this. It's an iterative process. At each stage, you might be using a different frame, different approach, different methodology based on the question you're trying to answer. But really, this process is, it builds on each other. I don't see sort of a particular end point to this. So I think evidence building and evaluation sort of is a kind of that river that runs through it. So you want to do that even post establishing a strong evidence base for a program. You might be looking more at, you know, the fidelity of implementation. Your questions might be pointed at that, at the first phase of replication or expansion or adaptation, and then continue to build that evidence of effectiveness, because it is always, you know, at the end of the day, you want to sort of strengthen that body of evidence. So, I just don't see that as an end game to this.
I would add also, because I think I hear a little something different in your question. Part of what the next phase of this project is, by going into the three case study sites, is to learn intentionally from folks who've had varying experiences and success with scaling, and not only from the evidence perspective, but what was it that made people decide to scale? What happened along the way? Some people have decided to intentionally scale back, and why is that? So it's both a sort of programmatic, I think, decision as well as an evidence decision, which is just, I think, it's a little something I heard also in your question. So we hope to learn from them what those things are.
Okay, so a few questions online. This is from Jennifer Bagnell Stewart. I'll just read a few of them because a number of them have come in. Are the conditions for scaling shown in the scaling framework based on the theoretical model or based on findings from the review of grantee-generated evidence?
That's easy. They're based on, I don't know that you'd call it a theoretical model, but it's a model. It's based on scaling that has been done by other in other areas, the principles that have been derived from those other areas. The framework was actually developed, Mathematica developed the framework before this project. So,
okay, thank you. So this is from Tina Dumphy. Can you provide some examples of the programs supported by CNCS grants that were part of the research conducted to date?
What was the question?
Can you provide some examples of the programs supported by CNCS grants that were part of the research conducted to date?
Well, when we did the metasynthesis meta-analysis, we were careful to look at what focus areas were addressed by the program. So we recognized that while we run six focus areas, we have activity in those six areas. We really were producing evidence in three of them to an appreciable degree, and one of them to a very appreciable degree, and that was evidence. So many of the programs that we looked at had to do with education interventions. Secondary to that, then, were economic opportunities, and those were back-to-work programs or budgeting programs, fiscal or financial learning programs, and that sort. And in the evidence area, the things we looked at spanned, you know, pre-K all the way up through college readiness and college completion. So we had evidence in all of those areas, but the strongest ones emerged, the ones that we looked at hard for selecting the process evaluations, were primarily in health, education, and then healthy futures. And they had to do with mostly pre-K and early childhood learning, and then healthy futures, again, around early childhood development, child abuse prevention. Those were the programs that emerged with the strongest evidence and also provided us with a great deal of variety with regard to their scaling experiences. We didn't want to pick three successful scaling projects. We wanted to pick projects that had varying degrees of success and had to retrench and rethink going forward what they were going to do so that they could teach us something about that whole process. But in terms of the specific grantees, no, we're not at a point where we want to release those just yet, because we have to announce who we selected for the process evaluations and then also who we're going to approach to help serve on our field working group. And that's not public knowledge yet.
Thank you. I'll take one more from here and then we'll open it up here. So Diane Mannheim, this model seems to give preference to research-based interventions rather than field-based success. Mm-hmm. Will this limit interventions with promise that are considered?
Well, I guess almost by definition, the answer is yes. You know, we're only looking at those with evidence. I don't know what to say. Yes.
But what I wanted to say was actually the mechanism we've created with this field work group is to draw on a broader set of experiences. So we have the ones that are promising also feeding into this. But, you know, you want to start with a foundation of what has had some evidence that it works and has been sort of tested in some replication and expansion processes. So,
I would also like to add that while interventions are not equivalent across all of our grantees, neither are evaluations. That grantees choose to do an evaluation and have a limited budget, they have a limited time frame, they approach it from different perspectives, and that produces the types of evaluations that we have to look at and determine the strength of that. And those evaluations may find very positive impacts, and that may very well be true, but they may be missing components in the explanation of that finding that limit our really embracing that as strong evidence. So part of this project is designed to identify what are those key components that need to be looked at in an evaluation, regardless of who's doing it. They need to consider these components when reporting that, so that when we look at it, we can make a fair judgment across all of them. And that's part of the learning process that's going on now.
And can I just add, you know, taking it, if I can be, you know, have a little latitude here, taking it out of the CNCS framework and into the broader, you know, evaluation and scaling framework, just for a sec. You have to start somewhere with this process. You know, CNCS has to start somewhere. The evaluation world has to start somewhere. And, you know,
I don't think anyone, I'll let you guys speak for yourself, is saying that, you know, evidence-based and then you go into the scaling and apply the framework for readiness for scaling is the be-all and end-all right now. But it's a good, solid place to start. And that doesn't mean that once this pipeline that's no longer on the screen, you know, is followed, that you can't start varying the pipeline. And it's sort of just like, you know, building evidence and scaling. It's this process is much like it. You start somewhere and then you see if you can go in a different direction, just like scaling takes you in a different direction. And I do think this is a solid place to start this process and this thinking.
So this is Clint again from the Congressional Research Service. And by the way, I'm speaking only for myself now, not for my agency bosses. But maybe building on that observation and question. So the tiered evidence model, you know, sets up kind of a troika, promising to proven, whatever, I don't like the term proven, but I wonder with your case studies if you might find if the model creates perverse incentives for grantees to go for the money.
It would be
rather than going, you know, to get you know, stuff in the strong category instead of promising, because it's almost like they're self-diagnosing and they might, you know, pick an intervention off the shelf that right. may not be fully suitable for their circumstances. And I wonder if your case study approaches might be looking at that to the extent that's a potential phenomenon out there.
Hopefully we'll get at that. You know, hopefully the case studies will provide some insights in it. You know, again, it's not the case studies. It's not like we're doing millions of them, but you know, hopefully we'll get, what you raise is something that I do think about a lot, the perverse incentives. And it's a great question and but you're on the lookout for it. Yeah.
Another thing, though, I want to say is it also offers opportunity because if you really have programs that solve challenges in the communities and you have a lot of evidence that they do, then you want to be in a position to bring that to communities that don't have access to those solutions. So I think part of this is moving us in the direction where you're attempting to, because at the end of the day, the goal is not the evidence, the goal is to solve challenges on the ground. And if we have solutions, we want to be able to bring them where they're needed. And then that would allow for us to also have that ability to innovate and, you know, support that innovation and promise while you're really trying to bring solutions where you know that there is merit to those solutions. So I think it's straddling these lines and always being aware that you have to be intentional and look at it and make sure you're not creating those perverse incentives and you're sort of being stewards of taxpayer money, I think, as far as we're concerned, being in this position.
Hi, Amy Jidlow, OMB. Yeah, this tension of funding, the evidence, you know, this is more of a kind of just general comment, but like funding the evidence across $700 billion, you know, 1,800 different federal programs. I don't think anyone, including the corporation, is indicating that, you know, at the exclusion of funding innovation grants. I mean, you know, considering the spectrum, the tiered model, you know, I can't stand a reason that everyone's going to put the money into what works and not perhaps fund, you know, the grantees that are still learning and tweaking and, you know, experimenting. So, you know, to perhaps calm some of the, you know, grantees on the phone or, you know, what have you. Yeah, this is a spectrum and, you know, there's going to be, you know, innovation grants and then, you know, the kind of those that are higher up the tier.
Oh, two more questions.
Okay. This is Lisbeth Little again with DHS. I was wondering what exactly then is the purpose of this study? Is it to test this model of scaling. And you said also something that was true. You have to start somewhere. And I've heard it mentioning that there were three case studies that will be considered. If we have to start somewhere, you know, because I also heard the description of the studies or the interventions that have been considered, and they are pretty different from each other, education, health, mental health, and that. So if we need to start somewhere with a framework that we want to test, I mean, assuming that this is really the purpose of the study, wouldn't it be wiser, okay, so it's probably a question of research methodology, to focus more on, for example, case studies that are similar somewhere, so that you have preliminary information on a framework that is focused on some kind of specific content or population, rather than just going across, you know, very different interventions to see a framework with information about its effectiveness based on three interventions that are so different. You see where I'm going into in terms of focusing the study to really then what are we going to learn about it if we have to start somewhere and how we're going to start that somewhere if we're also spread out.
Now, I just want to say your point is well taken, but I think you have to kind of think about the context a little bit. So CNCS works across various focus areas. We are, in that sense, we are unique. Like, we're not Department of Education. We're not, you know, we have national service. Sort of our base is a bit different. So we have a broad spectrum of programs that we fund across the nonprofit sector. And I think that's partly what has made us sort of venture into different directions. If we were a Department of Ed, probably we started with a much more narrower thing. But this is not to negate what you're saying. We are sort of starting, as you said, somewhere. And I think as we learn more, we'll decide what is the best strategy to go forward. Because at this point, we have looked at what we have in terms of an evidence base. We've looked at the strongest solutions that we've funded. And we're looking at them as a test case to see what we're learning about, you know, getting them again to communities across the country. And it doesn't mean we're not going to look back and rethink this as we learn more.
Can I also add that I don't see this as a testing of the framework. I see the framework as sort of setting parameters for what we're looking at. I totally agree. If we were testing a framework, that it would be better to have, you know, interventions that are pretty similar, you know, and but maybe vary the context in which they're unfolding or something like that. But I don't see it as testing the framework. I see the framework as providing structure to what we're doing, and then feeding off of what Lily says is really trying to provide practical, very practical, I hope, information to CNCS and the grantees about the challenges and this, you know, what are the challenges you're going to face when you scale, and what are, you know, what can help you overcome them. And given the fact it's practical knowledge in the array of programs that CNCS funds, we really did want to give a broad view.
Okay, so I'm just going to take a couple more. Oh, can go ahead.
Hi, this is Lori Frank, Health and Aging Policy Fellowship. Part of what I think some of us are wondering about is your sampling frame or the selection for this. And I'm interested in your orientation toward or tolerance for modification. It's the butterfly question. At what point does scaling become innovation because things have changed so much in the course of scaling? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the way we set up our project is to in hopes that to tackle that. And I think, you know, one of the things Nan talked about in the framework is it's not just what are the elements, but what are the core elements of the program. So something of the intervention. So at what point, you know, are you deviating so far from that you're really scaling something entirely? So, but that if you are making modifications or adaptations, which of course are necessary, and when you're trying to bring it to new contexts, you might have to do that. But are you staying true to maybe some of the core essential elements of the intervention to stay grounded in the underlying evidence for it, or are you deviating so much from it? And if you happen to deviate from it, are you doing it in a way that, as Nan said nicely, that's purposeful, that's mindful? Are you bringing in evidence or underlying justifications to say we are changing the dosage, which is that existed for the original model, but we feel confident because we're bringing in this evidence to support our. So the way we reviewed some of these documents is, what is the adaptation? But we also wanted to collect information of, did the grantee justify, or did they provide a rationale for why they are doing it too? So we were very mindful of that adaptation is sometimes necessary, and it's also, it happens, but are you doing it in a way that's at least informed by evidence or for some other rationale too, and staying hopefully true to the original model, but knowing maybe you're tweaking around the edges of it.
Is that answered?
Thank you, yeah.
Okay, so just a few from online. Vicki Jones, she wants to know about the best practices for identifying quote unquote organizational readiness for scaling. And she points to slide 3, and she said it seems fuzzy, qualitative rather than quantitative. So it's more of a remark. If you could move to that slide 13.
Or slide 3 or slide 13?
13, I believe. It's more of a comment.
It is more of a comment, and I agree. I'm trying to think of a succinct way of answering the comment or addressing the comment. I guess the succinct way of saying it is underlying each of these bullets are sub-bullets and then sub-bullets to the sub-bullets. And so when we say, leaders and key stakeholders and partners support the interventions, we've got under that operational definitions of what that means. And then sometimes under those operational definitions, it gets more specific. So what I've presented is sort of the first line, very high level, and very astutely, you've noticed that there's a lot that goes under this.
Do you want to say something about it? Okay. So just moving on to one few more. Sandy Schiffers, if the intervention keeps changing, then isn't it impossible to conduct an RCT or even a QED? So I think back to adaptation.
I do think that this, the whole RCT experimental design studies, as many of you know, come from natural sciences where the situation is much more controlled. And I do think that if a program is making a lot of adaptations and tweaking and refinement, it is not at a point where an RCT or a quasi-experimental design should be done. It typically has to, program has to be mature and stable enough with a number of other qualifiers, like many things need to be well defined to make that a worthwhile endeavor. And as you all know, some of those types of evaluations are fairly expensive. So it's, you don't want to just do it willy-nilly, and you want to do it at the right time. So I want to acknowledge that and say that is not an appropriate time. If the program is not ready for an impact evaluation that's fairly rigorous, I don't think that it should be done. Also, there are certain programs that are just not constructed for this type of design, and we have to acknowledge that and move forward and sort of use the best methodology for studying a program based on its sort of stage of development, if that makes sense.
And I can add on to that. It also, and Nan mentioned this nuance too, there's a, brings up the nuance of the program model and then that for which was actually evaluated. And you want to make sure that you're specifying that you might have started, oh, we're going to be over here with the model that we're testing. But if you made so many modifications, then you're not actually testing that anymore. You're testing what you know, the adaptations and having clear specifications that, we started with this teacher practice program, but because of these modifications, well, the evidence is now for those modifications. But then is the study done well because of all the changes along the way too. So it still also speaks to, you really need to be really clear about what you're actually studying, both in terms of the original conception, but then actually what happened in practice. Because what happened in practice, that's the evidence.
So in terms of models, I'll read this and I'll open it up to the live audience. This is Zia Schatz. Hello, I'm looking for examples of high quality evidence models and evaluation models, methods, and scaling projects specifically for environmentally based interventions. There are great examples that involve social services and educational interventions and how populations of people are affected, but few related to the environment.
I'm sorry, I was...
But there's few, in terms of environmentally based interventions, are there any examples that mostly they're in education and social services?
It's true that we looked at the strongest programs we have with regard to both their evidence and also their activity in terms of the, you know, when we look at the grants, they're scaling up or they're scaling out or they're scaling deep. And they provided us with an opportunity to look at some variation and to pull some knowledge from that. With regard to a lot of our programs, particularly in the conservation area, yes, we want to look at different programs and scale them. But the first question you might ask is, scale them in what direction, or how do you want to scale this? Is it scaling up? Is it scaling in one particular focus area, or is it scaling in another focus area, such as, or using that focus area rather to measure scaling, such as capacity building? And we've spoken about this. There's a lot of ways to do evaluations and a lot of ways to look at what those outcomes are and then study those outcomes in a rigorous way. And I think a lot of programs are just learning that. And we're hoping that this project will identify those key elements that all programs can use in response to some of the other statements that were made about whether or not an intervention changes so much it's hard to measure it. You know, certainly that would be a concern, but one of the things we certainly know is that if you scale, you need certain components to be present to do that. The organizational and the intervention, well-defined and all of that stuff. And I think in some areas, some of our grantees are going to have to think hard about how they define their intervention and look at that and what does that mean? And then what are ways of measuring that out from there? So we're hoping that this applies to all of our grantees across all of our focus areas, that key elements will be relevant to them as well. And hopefully we can provide some guidance with regard to where they might go.
Questions? Any from here?
I'm sorry, I was
not paying attention. Okay, so Leticia Braga, have efforts been made to compare the evidence standards across agencies? For example, the Department of Education uses the terms moderate and strong evidence, but the definitions include different components. What do you see as the balance between adapting definitions to the needs of specific agency area of focus and having enough commonality to develop a common vocabulary?
I can take that one. So yes, I think this is something that we are doing and have done. We had actually a tiered evidence work group that was meeting for a while, specific around the tiered evidence program. This was one of the questions that came up quite a bit, and something that members of the group discuss on a regular basis. I think the group's been on a little bit of a hiatus, but you know, we're thinking about potentially some additional meetings, particularly around this very question. Mm-hmm. I think it is a balance. So there's certainly some desire to standardize. And if you look at some of the recent legislation that has included tiered components in one way or another, you'll see that those definitions are starting to converge and that new programs are sort of referring back to definitions that are already in statute. So we definitely are seeing that. I think at the same time, there's recognition that the evidence base is not the same in all areas, that there are certainly some policy areas for which we have very little evidence and a priority should be on building that evidence base. Whereas in other areas, the evidence base is much more well developed and that might be more amenable to a tiered structure with that higher level. So I think it is a balance. On some level, we want to set the aspiration high that in any, you know, in all areas, we would hope that, you know, the evidence base is developed sufficiently to eventually get to that highest level. While also recognizing that, you know, it does vary quite widely. But, you know, I appreciate the question. I think it's something that is on quite a few people's minds these days.
Any questions?
Yes, I have a question. So for Nina Kerr from NIH, maybe I'm going further back in the pipeline. I'm not completely sure how CNS,
CNCS's grant mechanism works exactly, but I was curious specifically about the health-focused programs and grants. Is does CNCS consume information from NIH for like aging and early childhood type of work? Is there a dialogue already going on?
I wouldn't say it's ongoing. I mean, we have, particularly in the space of aging, we have had conversations and enjoyed some of their sort of, I don't know, retreats, if you will, with some of their researchers with the overlap with Senior Corps. So there are occasions where we try to sync up, and certainly in the example of the Senior Corps augmentation grants that I think were referenced early on, you know, there is a list of NIA, you know, evidence-based programs that they select from. Right. So wherever we can find those natural synergies, we try to definitely, you know, do so. In early education, I would say there's been more tenuous conversations. We've had stronger conversations at IES and the Department of Ed in the prior administration than we've had in the current, but it's always an aspiration.
Okay, yeah, I was at NIA before, and I remember meeting with Erwin Tan.
Yes, exactly. At the time. Yeah.
So I was curious how it is in the other areas.
Yes. Okay.
All right, so Mary Newton says, I'm not sure I understand what you mean by scale. It sounds like a fancy name for expand. Can you clarify this term a little bit more?
Okay, where was that slide? 7? Making that up. 8. So expansion is, you know, certainly one form. But we have put definitions to scaling, and your question is spot on in that the first thing you have to do is define scaling, and people define it in very different ways. So, you know, expansion is one part of it, but we've set the definition of expansion to more people, more of the same target population in the same area, in the same location. So you're just sort of growing your business, so to speak, where you are. You know, but then we do go beyond that and talk about replication, where you've got the same program in a different location, maybe a different organization, wherever, with the same population. And then the adaption, which is the one I think that we're all struggling with, because it is modifying the intervention or modifying it for a new population, that really is the heart of, you know, the discussion, and when does it become a new intervention. So we do have these three definitions. They're not quite standard, you know, across the field. People do define it differently, but this is what we invoked.
And then Allison Augustine actually has a question that is a bit of a follow-up. One of the indicators CityYear uses to assess whether we can scale our program is marketplace demand. By that I mean the extent to which our school district partners are requesting our services and willing to invest to support them. Being able to respond to district needs, share our strategy, and show the effectiveness of our program allows us to do that. But scaling won't happen without the market, quote unquote, demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we also try to mind, yeah, the local context itself. You don't want to bring an intervention where there may not be a need for it, or if there's not enough. If you say you want to expand, but there's no more population to expand to, then that wouldn't be a successful effort. So in addition to not just the demand, it's also the support that might exist too. I mean, our framework is specifically on the intervention readiness and the organization readiness, but that's not to say that the local context and reading where you're trying to expand or replicate or adapt, that also is very important for the success of the scaling too.
And I also add that I think the local context and demand for the intervention does affect whether you scale up or scale down. You know, we're using the word scaling, but scaling down
or the type of
shrinking, you know, is captured in local demand.
Okay, so we're near the end, but I just want to give everyone, I know Mary's going to close, but are there any last comments from the live audience? or Anthony, Lily, any of the speakers?
Okay. Well, thank you again to our speakers and to those who provided comments, and as well to the audience who's joined us in this discussion today. Special thank you to our ICF colleagues, as well as our other R&E colleagues and our friends at OMB, who have really tried to pull all this together and coordinate this series. It's been a nice collaboration. We will be sending out a post-webinar survey, so please let us know your thoughts on this webinar or ideas for future webinars, and we will post this recording in about a month. So thank you for joining, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you.